Welcome everyone who is listening to Canine Nose Time Chats. We're talking puppies. Yay. Hi, Daniel. Hey.
Hello.
It'd be really cool to just do a little chat about, I know you have a new puppy.
I do have a new puppy.
And so we'd have a little talk about your puppy and maybe what you do and your business. And maybe if you want to start with that, give us a bit of a rundown of Confident Canines.
Okay, so Confident Canines is my business. It's just a run-of-the-mill dog training business. I teach puppy classes at a vet clinic. I also do private puppy training in people's homes if that's what they prefer, as well as a bit of behavior consultation, reactivity work, and that sort of stuff.
How did you get into, what made you decide to start Confident Canines?
I think my story mirrors a lot of dog trainer stories in that I had a troublesome dog. So Crosby was my troublesome dog. He basically was this gorgeous black lab puppy. And when he hit 18 months, he suddenly was a monster. You know, and I'd done puppy class with him and thought, oh, you know, that's enough, as a lot of people do think. But he was just out of control, couldn't walk him on lead. He screamed whenever he saw other dogs just because of the arousal that he had. So obviously I had to start doing stuff with him to address those issues. So my background is in human psychology. I was actually working on my master's in psychology when I got Crosby, and I just suddenly, like when I started learning about how I could help him, it was just like a switch in my brain. I was like, I love all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I love learning about dog behavior. It all fit with what I'd been training with in psychology, and I just loved it a little bit more than working with anxiety and depression in people. So I just started to do educational opportunities in dog behavior and training, and started to get more experience a lot at my local obedience club. And yeah, and then it just kind of grew from there.
Wow, that's your story is very, very familiar to me.
Yes.
I have a very similar sort of story. So what did you, when you sort of noticed, because 18 months, like it's probably just a coincidence, but that sort of age, you know, we had a family friend that had a really boisterous, I guess, lab, and that dog ended up getting rehomed at about 18 months old.
Yep.
And I'm assuming some part of that's breed, and part of that is they had no idea sort of what they were in for when they were getting a lab. Also that, you know, those building blocks weren't there when you know, they had her as a puppy. And I've got a my problem dog problem child, you know, he was reactive at 12 weeks old. I took him to puppy class, and he spent the whole of puppy class sitting on my lap because he was launching and aggressive at the other dogs. And I had zero, I was not prepared for it. I had this relatively normal 12-month-old border collie, and then I had this 12-week-old, you know, it's something I had no idea. I was in way over my head. And, you know, the breeder offered to have the puppy back, but it was too late by then. I was all in.
Yeah.
And here we are. So I guess, you know, there's so much you can do, but you need that support, and you need that support system. And I got a certain way having all of that type of support, probably like what you do with your business. But you just can't do it on your own.
No. And it's, I mean, I think the thing with dogs is like, so many of us just grow up with a family dog, or we see our friends with dogs, and it all seems kind of easy, right? Like dogs just fit into our lives. And I think that's true for a certain proportion of dogs. They do kind of roll with the punches and fit into our lives in some way that is convenient to us. But when you get a dog that's like needs so much more than that, it just kind of opens your eyes up to all the things that go into making a dog happy and confident and successful in living with us, because it's not easy. It's not easy for lots of dogs.
No, and it's not easy for their humans too. Mm. Often, like, I think people probably, until you had a problem dog, people really don't understand.
No.
But I'm wondering, like, I know you sort of touched on that, but how much of an asset that human psychology degree has come into play with dogs and the humans?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's one of the most worthwhile things to me. Like, I don't think I could have just launched straight into doing this as a business without that as a foundation, because it means that I, you know, all the learning theory stuff just fits in really easily with me. Like, my brain was already sort of primed to understand all that stuff. And also just, I really don't like directly sort of comparing dog anxiety with human anxiety. But at the same time, there is a lot of similarity. So when you do deal with anxious dogs, I mean, in humans, we do, you know, cognitive behavior therapy, where we can explain what we're doing. And the cool thing with dogs is that we kind of do the same things with them, as in terms of, you know, gradual exposure therapy and desensitization and all that sort of stuff, but we can't explain it using our human language. So it kind of, you kind of have to be even more creative and work in understanding the dog's perceptions and their point of view, which makes it really fun. So I love that psychology has helped me kind of dive straight into that area when working with dogs. And also the other thing is with working with people, right? Because I'd already had experience kind of coaching people, working on getting behavior change in people, because that's often a really hard part with dealing with dogs and puppies, is like, it's not just fixing the dog or the puppy, you have to change the human's behavior as well. So
I mean, 100%, and that's the bigger piece of the puzzle, isn't it?
Exactly.
I thought I was getting into the dog business. That was wrong.
Yep.
I was not.
No. It's all about coaching people. So you know, you need a lot of empathy training, like, and active listening and all that sort of stuff that I'd already learned through my psych degree. That was really helpful.
Yeah, I think you're so right. I think a lot of dog trainers are actually really empathetic people. Mm-hmm. And they have to be. Well, the good ones, you know, they really have to be.
Yeah.
So when you made that sort of decision, or I'm assuming it was probably a process, like, for all of us, and it's all of a sudden you're like, oh, here we are.
Yep.
What sort of dog related, learning did you decide to take?
So originally I did a hands-on course with Steve and Vicky Austin. Who still run dog trainer educational opportunities. They have some really great courses. And that was fun because the hands-on component, you know, we did it at a boarding kennel. So you could, like, we could just, you know, work with dogs that we didn't have any experience working with before, dogs that we didn't know their history, and, you know, do some training with these sort of blank slate dogs, which was really fun. And so that was kind of my start in working with a wider range of dogs. And then a lot of just online learning opportunities. Like, there's so much stuff to do. In fact, I almost think there's too much stuff you can learn online, and you kind of have to figure out what's going to be beneficial to you. So I did lots and lots of online learning just for training my own dogs. So stuff like Fenzi Dog Sports Academy was really cool, to just play around with my own dogs, teaching them a bunch of different things. One of the main learning opportunities that was really valuable to me was doing Dr. Susan Friedman's online course in behavior analysis. I absolutely love that, because it was really just taking the sort of behavior analytical model from human psych and showing how it applied to animals, which was a perfect fit for me because that's just what I just loved. And her style of teaching is just awesome. It's a really cool experience to do. Even if you don't want to be like a full-on dog trainer, it's just such a cool learning experience.
Awesome. I think that's sort of interesting that you started with Vicky and Steve Austin, because Steve Austin, in regard to scent work, was one of the very early on, he was someone I really sort of looked up to.
Yep.
Went to everything I could that he sort of put on, and he's got, you know, had this book, Motivating Miracles, I think it was called.
Yep.
Which I really like when you apply it to scent work and canine nose work, was, you know, so many light bulbs went on for me just learning from him.
Absolutely. And actually that's where I started teaching Crosby nose work. Was I used him as my project for that course in teaching him nose work. So that was his very first experience doing any sort of sense detection stuff.
Awesome. Oh my goodness, let's start talking about the puppies.
Yeah. Yeah,
because we could talk forever about this.
I know.
Like I think it is important to choose what you're learning online as well.
Yeah.
Touching on that, it's
and
it sounds like, you know, there is just so much information out there.
There is, and it's almost like you kind of need to do a few things and decide the style you like, the people you like to follow. But it's also like you want to follow different sorts of people as well. Like you shouldn't just go down one path and not learn different approaches. So yeah, there's a lot. You can spend a lot of money.
Oh yeah. But that's probably the reason you start a business, right? So you can put it
Yeah.
I really enjoy going to different instructors and people that don't necessarily align with how I train.
Exactly.
And not just to you know, confirmation bias that I'm right or wrong, but just to, you can always adapt and learn something from someone else and go, oh, okay, you know, whether it's little pieces or big pieces to add to your own sort of training. And that's the great thing about, you know, all the different, even live and online, whatever, however it goes.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your puppy. I know that when you got Nettle, the timing wasn't ideal because we did sort of touch on Crosby.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, maybe it was ideal. I don't know.
Yeah, it's been a very a huge emotional roller coaster the past few months, because I'd kind of had my name down on a few breeders lists for puppies for like the last year or so, because I was kind of feeling the urge to get a puppy. And Crosby unexpectedly became quite unwell, and we had to make the decision to say goodbye to him in October. And 3 days after he died, one of the breeders I'd been in contact with emailed me and said she thinks she did indeed have a puppy for me. So it was like this huge, oh my gosh, in the midst of, you know, saying goodbye to your heart dog, you suddenly have to start preparing for a new puppy. And I did have a momentary thought of, is this right? Should I maybe take more time and say no to this particular puppy? But I decided to go for it. So, and I think it was the right decision, because even though, I mean, I never think of dogs as just sort of replacements for dogs you've lost. It's not really how my brain works. But there is a huge hole when a dog suddenly leaves you. And particularly because Crosby was a special dog, so he was blind. So he took up a lot of my day in terms of caring for him and the things we did together. So for him to just suddenly be out of my life, it just left such a huge hole. And then there was a puppy coming along to fill up a lot of that space, which has been really good, I think.
That probably takes up just as much or more time.
Oh my gosh, it's even more, because puppies don't understand like 8 hours sleep.
No. I'm wondering if because I know you were fairly specific with what you were looking for in a puppy and breeder, temperament, all the rest of it. And I was, did that sort of influence the decision to say, look, now's the time. We might not get this opportunity again.
100%. So basically I decided on a spaniel, mostly because of the size. So I'm a retriever and a spaniel person. I've got my golden retriever. I've obviously had a lab. My sister, who I live with, has the Springer Spaniel. And I've always kind of loved what I've seen of working Cocker Spaniels, but there aren't too many breeders in Australia. One of my criteria was that I really wanted to be able to pick my next puppy up. I didn't want a puppy flown to me. I know that lots of people have their puppies flown to them and it's no big deal, but I kind of had decided, you know what, it is a stress on a puppy that I can avoid by just being able to drive and pick up a puppy. So that kind of narrowed down who I could get puppies from. And in fact, the breeder who I got this puppy Nettle from, she's actually just moved to Queensland. So it's worked out well because this was her last litter in New South Wales. So I think it was just meant to be.
Yeah.
The other thing I was really looking for in terms of a puppy was also how the breeder raised the litter. You know, you can do lots of research about what puppy breeders do, but I really just wanted someone who did lots of enriched puppy raising along the lines of something like Puppy Culture, you know, gave their puppies lots of learning opportunities. The breeder I chose did a lot of work on like crate conditioning. So the puppies loved their crates and could sleep in the crates by themselves before they came home, which just makes life so much easier when you bring that puppy home.
Oh, wow.
So that's why I really liked the breeder. I really loved her dogs and her puppies. So when Nettle became available, I was like, yep, I think it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I just had a flashback to my first dog, Syrah, when we got her. I'd never had a dog before. She's my first ever dog. And the first couple of nights, sleepless nights, and we'd stacked up some boxes to keep her in one spot of the house.
Yep.
This is where, like, I just... there's such vivid memories. And I always say that she's the worst behaved puppy we've ever had. Range is obviously the best behaved puppy, but
of course,
you know, the reason why she was the worst behaved puppy, and I've fostered about 30 puppies since, was because I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea about management. I had someone gave me a border collie puppy. that vision of her being stuck in a bunch of boxes and I wish I had this information now when I got her, because she's an amazing dog.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Nettle. How old is she? How's she going?
Yeah. So she turned 16 weeks old yesterday, which is interesting because 16 weeks is basically, well, it's what a lot of people think is sort of the end of the puppy imprinting or socialization period. So she's kind of heading into, she's doing a lot of teething now, so I think she's got about a month before she kind of maybe turns into a naughty adolescent dog, maybe, we'll see. So she's 16 weeks, and which is crazy because it means I've had her for 8 weeks. I think things are going well. I think I've fit in most of the things I wanted to in that time period. Because it can be a bit of a ticking time bomb where you kind of, I mean, you can go online and read all these socialization checklists and think of all the things that you want your puppy to learn straight away, and it can kind of freak you out. And I actually think that's what happened a bit with me and Rory. I was like, oh, we have to do all the things straight away and make sure we do everything right. Whereas for Nettle, I've kind of been more relaxed. Obviously, I've had ideas about what we can do and what we want to work on. But I've kind of just been enjoying her and just letting her be a crazy puppy and exploring the world together. It's been pretty fun.
Oh, I love that. That word, so over socialization, comes to mind with them. I feel like that's what I sort of, you know, I wanted to tick all the boxes and do everything. And you're yep. so right. I think it's more important just to go at your own pace and at your dog's pace as well.
Absolutely. Because one of the things that I wish I'd done differently with Rory was really slow down and get to know his personality a bit more, because obviously, so Rory's a golden retriever, and in my head I was envisaging this, you know, bouncy, waggy-tailed, over-enthusiastic, sweet, friendly, sort of stereotypical golden retriever. And he was flown to me, so he came from Western Australia in a plane, and I picked him out. I got the pick of the litter, and I picked him. And I realized I picked him because he looked so adorable in all the photos. And I think it's because he kept looking at the camera and with very soulful eyes. And I think that's because he is this really thoughtful dog, right? Because Nettle, at 8 weeks, you couldn't really take photos of her very well because she's constantly moving and bouncing and jumping around and everything. And Rory, when he arrived at the airport, when we went to pick him up, he sat in his crate for over 5 minutes. With the door open and me sitting there with his teddy bear, and he just was like, I'm not ready to come out of this crate. I don't know who you are. And it took 5 minutes of encouragement to get him to get out of the crate. So there were lots of signs that I should have realized that he was a very reserved, thoughtful, cautious, sort of slower type of dog. But in my sort of enthusiasm, I kind of just threw him into all the puppy socialization stuff without realizing that I should have gone a lot slower with him and done different things with him.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But yeah, he is so soulful and he is so thoughtful.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, you know, canine nose work, I think he's actually ironically really fast because he doesn't waste time.
No, I know. He it's funny because he doesn't move fast. But he does move with purpose. Like, he is
absolutely, you know,
yeah.
that's funny.
So I think with Nettle, it was really just, let's get to know you, let's have fun, and let's only do things that are within your ability to be able to deal with, right? So I think a lot of people don't watch their puppy's body language and look for those kind of really subtle signs of discomfort or uncertainty, or even on the flip side, real over arousal or over excitement, I think can be misinterpreted as like happiness, when actually they're kind of in that kind of over aroused, over threshold, sort of frantic sort of behavior. So if I was to give new puppy owners a really big tip, it's just get to know your puppy and their sort of, what is their personality? And it can be hard because you kind of have ideas in your head about what their personality should be. But every puppy's different.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I really like that. What are some of the things you're doing to sort of prepare Nettle for being, you know, a good pet, for first of all, a good living companion, but also I know you're wanting to do some sports with Nettle, agility and nose work. And so what are some of the things that you are, like, specific things you're doing with her to sort of set her up for that in the future?
Yes. So I think in terms of being a good pet, I think it's really just about her being able to live comfortably in our human world, right? Are you okay when guests come over? Can you say hello to people without freaking out or going crazy? Can you walk on a lead nicely? Can you come when called? All that sort of basic stuff, right? But I think the biggest thing the mistake people make is expecting too much of that stuff from puppies, like, straight away. And then when you have those high expectations, you can have a lot of frustration. So if you go out with your puppy on a lead, and you expect them to be able to walk nicely with you straight away, you're just setting yourself up and your puppy up for lots of frustration. Because it takes time to develop these skills, right? So mostly I think what's really helpful is developing communication, which is a lot at this age to do with sort of using food, I would say, like developing reinforcement that you can use to build the skills you need. So you can use food, you can use toys, you can use praise and attention and fun and love. But it's just letting your pup understand that, you know, their behavior can lead to good things. So when you come to me, when I call, we play, or I drop food on the ground, or some other really amazing thing, so that the next time I call, you're more likely to come. Yeah. And then just building up lots and lots and lots and lots of repetitions and reinforcement history to make those things more likely to happen.
Yeah, I think personally, I think recall is probably the biggest, one yeah. of the biggest. There's lots of important things to learn, but, you know, just to have that faith that your dog will come when you call.
I know.
Yeah, that's the power thing right there. And I've only met Nettle twice, but you know, she popped in when we were doing some lessons this week, and yes. That's one thing I really noticed is you guys have just incorporated that sort of constant training into just your everyday activities and interactions with her.
Yes.
So it's not like a structured training session as yes. such, but you know, just watching you guys, you brought her out the car just to have a little bit of an interaction in the area that we were training your other dogs.
Yep.
And you know, you when you called her, she was busy, you know, interacting with Nat, but she just mm-hmm. literally turned around and like top speed from the first step to sprint towards you. And it was just so beautiful. It was so cute. And I'm like,
And the thing is that a lot of puppies will already have this sort of ability, but you have to reward them enough that they yeah. keep on doing it, right? Because we can kind of take it for granted that, oh, the puppy comes when I make loud noises and that's their recall, but it's not enough because, like you say, you have to be able to call them away from stuff, right? So when they're having fun and you call them, they have to realize that there's fun to be had with you rather than yeah. when they are.
And to her, it looked like a game, and you know, exactly, puppies yeah. love games.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And like you say, I think you can find those training opportunities like throughout your day. Like it shouldn't just be like, I'm going to grab some treats and go in the garden and train my dogs mm-hmm. for 5 minutes, right? Because yeah, you can kind of make progress doing that, but you're missing out on all the other chances throughout the day you have to practice all these things.
Mm-hmm. And to reinforce good behavior when it does happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So recall is huge.
It's a safety thing for me as well.
Absolutely.
Especially if you end up having a reactive dog. I have this one recall story. You know, I'd never take for granted my dog's recall because he can be so you know, over the top and fixated because he's very dog reactive dog.
Yeah.
Also postman reactive, which is funny. Well, not really funny in this instance, but I'm very careful about having double barriers and everything when you have a yeah. reactive dog, and there's always two ways to get out and whatnot. This one day, the postman had come down the street and we live on a busy road, and I don't know how Ranger got out the front door, but he was hackles from head to tail. He was sprinting, barking after the postman who was on the opposite side of the busy road. And I just screamed, you know, Ranger, come. He screeched to a halt right at the road and literally like ran back to me. And I'm like, okay, let's, you know, I'm
yep.
so yep. emotional for one, going, oh my gosh, that recall just saved my dog's life.
Well, I know.
Also, I'm never going to try that again. but it really can. It is such an important, to me, it's one of the most important things to teach your dog.
Yeah, you can't practice it enough, and you can't reward it enough. Like I tell my puppy classes, like, this is the one behavior you should be rewarding absolutely every time.
Yeah.
Because it's only in those like sort of emergency situations that you maybe want to not have that reward, but you want your dog to think that there's something, like you want it to be this conditioned, absolute, if when I hear you call me, I know I have to get you because good stuff is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And it becomes part of their standard, you know, response too. Like I just, that if it's just that one time that it works and you don't have a treat, I didn't have a treat, obviously.
Yep, exactly,
but if it's that one time that it works, that's all you need sometimes.
Yep.
Yeah. You mentioned crate training, which is another thing I think is amazingly important after my first experiences with Syrah, with the boxes. And how do you go about crate training? I think you've had the sort of a little bit of an added benefit there with the breeder being on board with that.
So my first advice is to find a breeder that does that. But if you've already got a puppy and you're not that lucky, I definitely still think you should get on top of crate training. One reason I love crate training is that it's just such a useful life skill to have. Mm-hmm. For any puppy. So obviously with our like sport dogs, it's useful to have, you know, out and about at trials and competitions and classes, seminars, that sort of stuff. So it's super useful in all of those sport dog settings. But for pet dogs, I think that it's useful not just for like puppy containment, toilet training, sleep training and all that sort of stuff, but it's just a good life skill to have. Like anytime your dog goes to the vet, they're going to be in a tiny crate if they're having an operation or something. And in fact, if your dog has had a like blown their cruciate or something and then they need to be on crate rest, it is, you know, torture for all of you to have to have a dog on crate rest that isn't crate trained. So I absolutely encourage everyone to do some sort of crate training. I think the most important thing is to get to know your puppy's sleep and wake cycles, and then you naturally use their need to sleep and use the crate at those times. So it shouldn't just be about, I'm going to shove my dog in the crate when I leave them, or my puppy's being naughty, I'm going to put them in the crate. If you have a puppy that doesn't have any experience with the crate, it should just be like, this is my favorite place to sleep when I'm really tired. So it's a cozy place. It's near where you are. Like it shouldn't just be in the laundry or the garage or something like that. It should be close to you because you need them to feel that sense of security and safety. And then, so like my crates are next to my bed. So, you know, I don't, eventually my dogs may end up sleeping on the bed, but when they're puppies, they're in a crate near the bed.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to do to create positive associations is you can feed your pup in the crate. So give them a Kong with yogurt or a bully stick or whatever you want to give your puppy. If you give them those sort of chewy treats or like a snuffer mat with food, anything like that, do it in the crate, right? So don't waste those sorts of food activities outside of the crate, because you can be using them to create those positive, relaxed sort of associations in the crate.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice.
The other thing I do with Nettle is that, so she has a crate, but she also has lots of, she has two main sort of puppy pens in the house. So because I live in a multi-dog house, in fact, a multi-dog, multi-cat house, you know, she can't just be running around the house annoying everyone and getting into trouble. So if she isn't being directly supervised, she needs to be contained in some way. So if she's not ready for a nap, not in that sort of relaxed sleeping, I can go be in my crate, I put her in a pen.
Yeah.
So it's really good to have that as an option as well, so that you're not overusing the crate and building up any sort of feelings of frustration or just distress with the crate.
Yeah, that's good advice. I have foster puppies, because most of the time they need to be quarantined from my dogs.
Yeah.
So that I have a sort of a large pen set up and a crate attached to it.
Yep.
And with all their sleeping stuff and whatnot in the crate, so it sort of just becomes, you know, after their 2 weeks quarantine or however long it is, It does sort of become a little bit second nature to them that that's just how it is.
Yep.
But it's such a valuable, you know, it makes life so much easier, even staying in hotels and,
absolutely,
you know, traveling with your dogs,
yep,
going to places. You can leave the boot up because, you know, your dog's secure in their, yep, crate. And,
yep,
yeah, I think it's one of the most valuable things to for your dogs to be able to interact with your sort of everyday life.
Absolutely.
Toilet training.
Well, actually, this ties into the crate and,
yeah,
and sort of thing, because I think the biggest mistake people make is giving their puppies too much freedom, mm-hmm, because puppies just pee everywhere. That's just what they do. So the main thing is to develop the habit you want from the get-go. So for me, probably actually the most onerous part of having Nettle is constantly taking her to the garden, because we have, you know, a deck and then stairs down to the garden, and she isn't yet old enough to be able to take herself out to the garden, right?
Yeah.
I also just don't really want her bounding down the stairs like a idiot puppy that she is. So it's a lot of lifting her up, taking her out, and encouraging her to go outside. And that's probably the hardest work, because you have to be super consistent. You have to take your puppy out as often as they need to eat. And for some puppies, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And it's just building that expectation that wherever you want them to eat is where you will take them. Lots of praise, and repetition, repetition, repetition. And the good thing with crates and pens is that ultimately, there's going to be times when my puppy makes mistakes because I'm busy or not watching, or I have to leave her alone for longer than she can handle. But if she makes that mistake in the pen or even the crate, I'm not super worried, because that's a specific context that she will grow out of, because she's not going to live her whole life in that pen situation. So to me, it's a whole lot of managing the environment so that you've got a lot of supervision and a lot of contingency plans.
Yeah. And when you say take your puppy out a lot,
yes,
you know, to me, that the word like 20 times a day could be very reasonable.
Yes.
yeah. Just to give people that are maybe getting a new puppy.
Oh my goodness, no, it is a lot. Because the other thing is that the annoying thing most puppies do is that they don't actually empty their bladders fully when they pee. People don't understand this.
No.
So, you know, yes, your pup could have peed. And I get a lot of people saying, oh, I took my dog out to pee and then I brought them inside and then they pee straight away again. And I'm like, yeah, this is just super common. This happens because one of the things is that puppies are kind of like, you know, super distracted, super excited. They can go outside to the garden and they can pee a bit and then, oh, there's a butterfly flying past, so I'm just going to chase the butterfly and forget about peeing. And then you bring them inside, they relax a bit and go, oh yeah, no, I did actually still need to pee. So you have to just take them out as often as they need, basically. I really, really like to have a cue word or cue words to encourage them to pee. Mm-hmm. And actually, I will say this is another really great thing my breeder did, because Nettle already knew go toilet meant kind of squat down and pee. So when you have those words associated with the behavior, you can use those words to remind your dog, your puppy, hey, it's weeing time. So I really encourage people to use some sort of cue word that means go toilet, go wee. And actually, that's very helpful for nose work, because we always want our dogs to pee before our searches.
Absolutely. I was just about to say, like, that is part of setting up for a good nose work partner,
exactly,
isn't it? Because, yeah, pee, search, pee. I'm a big fan of making sure you have a cue for your dogs.
Absolutely.
Okay, I have another question for you. Can you explain to me what swapsies is?
Okay, swapsies. So I love swapsies, which is basically a trading game for puppies. So because my puppies that I've raised are retrievers and spaniels, they're gun dogs, right? So they're mouthy dogs that like to pick things up and carry them around. Now, this isn't just a gun dog trait. Like most puppies will do this, but gun dogs in particular do it quite obsessively. One of the mistakes people make is freaking out when their puppy grabs stuff in their mouth. And it's a natural human response. Like your pup picks up something that you don't want him to have. You go, oh no, reach for it. And it might be a safety issue, or it might be something that's very precious to you and you don't want your puppy to have it. But what I have observed is that the more you kind of act like you want what they have, the more value you're creating in this game of grabbing stuff. So to counteract this, I just really like to have a rule from as soon as my puppies come home, whenever they have something in their mouth and I notice that, I'm like, oh, swapsies. And swapsies basically means I'm going to offer you a piece of food for whatever's in your mouth. So it just becomes whatever's in your mouth. If I say swapsies, you get a piece of food.
That's awesome.
I love it because it saves my butt a lot with like Nettle. Like she'll grab anything. She'll grab rocks. She'll grab rubbish off the ground. One thing people think is that by doing this, you're going to create a dog that does this more and more and more and more, right? They think that you're rewarding the dog for picking up rubbish or rewarding the dog for stealing your socks and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I try to assure people that, honestly, that is not what happens. Because most of the time when your pup does something like take your socks and then run around going, ha ha, I've got your socks, it's because we've created a sort of game out of the whole thing. Like your puppy grabs your sock, you go, oh my gosh, my sock. And then you chase your puppy around and try and get the sock out of their mouth. And that's where the fun is for the puppy because they love that kind of stuff. They love being naughty. They're just cheeky, gorgeous, cute puppies. So I don't want that game to be fun. I want it instead to just be a really simple, oh, you've got a sock. Let's play swapsies. And we just swap over for treats. And actually with Nettle's at a point where she knows it so well that even if I don't have food on me, if she grabs something, I can say, if I'm in the house and she grabs something, I'll just say swapsies. And then I'll move towards the fridge. And so she now knows, oh, even if I don't have food on me, swapsies still means we're going to go somewhere and get food.
I did notice because that's why I'd never heard that word before, and I saw Nettle pick up some rubbish the other day and she was having a great time, and you said swapsies and she got a piece of food, but she also didn't go back to pick up whatever she was playing with after the food. She's like, okay, that's done now.
Yes. And that's what I find with this behavior. It kind of it just makes it less interesting for them to hold on to items. And it just makes it normal for them. If they pick something up, I say swapsies, they put it down, they get the food, they forget about it. I did this heaps with Rory. He was super grabby. He would grab, because the thing with Rory is because he was a big golden puppy, it was really quickly that he was just grabbing stuff off counters and tables and stuff because he could reach stuff. And I just did this heaps with him. And the thing is that puppies grow out of it. The grabbing stuff randomly off surfaces, right? So once they grow out of that puppy grabby mouthy phase, I find that this behavior just kind of isn't even an issue. But you still have that swapsies cue to use when you need to, which is really, really helpful.
Yeah. And I guess it's similar to a leave it cue, is it? Or is it sort of has a different
learning? So I think it has a different thing. So I think I use leave it when a dog does not have possession of something, because I think it's a very different behavior for dogs if they're in possession of something and they give it up rather than they want something
And
you want them to not go get it.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. So like if you're preempting the behavior, and that's the leave it. That's when you would
say leave it. So leave it for me is my dog notices something, they kind of want it. And if I say leave it, that's a cue for them to go, oh, I'm not going to interact with that thing. So that's why you it, leave it can become helpful for stuff like, you know, leave it okay. as you walk past dogs, or yeah. leave it as you walk past the possum carcass on the ground.
Yeah, okay. No, that makes a lot of sense to me, which is and with the Swapsies, would you consider using a toy or a tug toy or something instead of food, or depending on your dog? Or
well, that's the cool thing, is that it kind of can help with cooperation with toy play, because you're kind of teaching, you know, an out behavior, like spit out what's in your mouth. Right? So I think it does have, you can absolutely, if your pup really wants a particular toy, you can absolutely play Swapsies and give them a particular toy that they want. So Nettle, for whatever reason, is obsessed with the cat toys. So for her, her number one value item in the house is cat toys. So I could absolutely use cat toys as the reward for playing Swapsies as much as I could use food.
Yeah, gotcha. Oh, okay, that's, yeah, very good. My other question I had was, what age do you think is a good age to start doing, say, particular activities? And I'm sure this sort of varies, but sort of say, I know that you want to do agility and nose work with Nettle.
Yeah.
What sort of age will you start putting a little bit more structure around around that?
I don't know. I mean, I think it really depends on the puppy, right? But I think that the general is you can probably, it's probably better to go slower than you think, because
yeah,
you can't, like, even with Nettle now, like I'm having fun training lots of really like small little foundation behaviors with her, and it's so tempting to just skip ahead to like the fun stuff that comes later on.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're raising a puppy, I think it's a constant sort of battle to go, no, just slow down, just take it easy, just concentrate on the foundations before you get too far ahead. And I think that for sports dogs, whatever the sport you're doing, the foundations are actually pretty similar. It's funny because you, as my nose work instructor, was like, don't add in the agility too soon. And then talking to an agility, Nettle's breeder is an agility person. She was like, don't add in the nose work too soon. Do the agility stuff there.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And so I just think it's funny because, you know, I think there are pros and cons to whatever order you choose to do things in with your puppy. But I do think that there's commonalities, right, between the two sports. Yeah,
absolutely.
I think for me, the biggest thing is just confidence and environmental stability and body awareness, which is super important for both sports. You know, nose work, you want your dog to be confident, moving on different surfaces, navigating tight spaces, being really confident around strange environmental obstacles and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of similar to agility. You want a really environmentally stable dog who knows how to use their body properly around obstacles in agility. So there's things that I think I'm doing now that are helpful for both those things. And I will say, like, I'm not really fixed on any particular goals for Nettle. Like, I think she'll be awesome at nose work. But, like, I'm going to try all the things with her. I'm going to do tricks, maybe a bit of retrieving. I don't know if I'll do formal obedience, but she'll probably be okay at rally or something like that. So, and I think the main thing is getting her reinforcement strategies. So, like, do I want to use toy play as a reward? I need to start thinking about that now and getting sort of her toy play skills at a place where I can use it as reinforcement. If I'm using food, do I want to use a marker system? Do I want to use a clicker? Do I want to use location specific markers? You can get all really fancy with all that sorts of stuff. And, you know, those are things that you can start doing now at her age.
And she is such a fun puppy. I think you've got so many options.
Yes.
With her, and I honestly think that's so wise that they're such good advice that you're giving for people to take their time, because it is so easy to just go, oh, my puppy's 6 months old and we're entering this, that and the other, and it's,
yeah,
you know, it's like, slow down, enjoy your puppy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that wisdom really only comes after you've had a few dogs.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it does help when you've got multiple dogs, because it's like, oh, you can't do fancy healing over bowls of food or whatever, but I can do that with Rory if I feel like doing that with Rory. So I think having multiple dogs is helpful as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Do you have any sort of parting words of advice? I'm sort of excited to get a new puppy now, but I will restrain.
Parting words of advice. I honestly think it's just enjoy your puppy. And if there's one thing you can't do too much, I think it's playing with them, right? Do all the tugging games, do all the fetch games, just be silly with your puppy. And don't be afraid to be silly with your puppy out and about in the world. I think puppies find it strange when we can kind of be really goofy and silly with them at home, but then when we're around people, we act kind of weird and stiff and boring. And I think having a puppy is a really great excuse to just go out in the world and act silly and have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'd love to pick your brain on, you know, we could do talks just on socialization.
Oh my gosh, and, yeah.
that's a whole nother.
Yes.
You know, there's so much to having a puppy.
Yes.
But I'm really excited to see how Nettle grows up. I'm super excited for when she, you know, might come to some scent work, nose work classes.
Yeah, she's going to be so fun. And she's going to be at nose work camp, which is going to be super fun as well.
Oh, good. Oh, wow. That's right. Yeah, yep. That's exciting. Oh, that's
very
a full
exciting
weekend of Nettle.
Yep.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for chatting today. It's been really good. I think I definitely would like to, before I get my next puppy, we need to do a number of these.
Yep.
so that I have my toolkit very well unstocked.
Yes, and there's there's so many more puppy topics we can talk about,
but this has been awesome, and I think it's also been a really good opportunity for Canine Nose Time students to get to know you a little bit more. I'll put Confident Canine details in the notes for this episode. And yeah, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.